Friends, the end is nigh. We are standing on the edge, staring down the last precipice of mankind. We, all those who hear these words, know now we will be witness to the last days of humanity. The holy books all foresaw the end days, and now it is our time. O eternal one, we have seen the signs, yet so many refuse to see, refuse to recognize the world coming down around our ears. The oceans are warming, rising, growing more acidic and full of plastic. Polar bears are starving to death, stranded on ice floes. It's coming to an end. Instead of fearing the end, it should be embraced.
What if we don't want things to end?
Why wouldn't you?
I mean, there's plenty of stuff to look forward to.
Like what?
Like kids. Kids are pretty cool, and they seem to be improving on a lot of the things we fucked up pretty bad.
Yeah, well, the ocean's warming is causing all sorts of extreme weather, hurricanes at increasing frequencies, California is perpetually on fire, we have tornado seasons that last all year long. What is that?
This is a...
Pumpkin?
It's a video of a porcupine eating a pumpkin.
What? How is it making that sound? I mean, Old Faithful at Yellowstone National Park? Turns out that's a tiny spout on a super volcano, people. The Eye of the Demon, 44 miles across. This thing is huge. And geologists say it erupts around every 800,000 years, and it's long overdue. It's going to blanket the country in a sea of thick volcanic ash.
I read that article. It is not overdue, and scientists will be able to tell long before it erupts.
But everything sucks. What is there even to look forward to?
I think horror movies are pretty cool. There's a bunch of them I'm looking forward to, and there's a bunch I still haven't seen.
Dogs and cats living together, mass hysteria.
I'm just obsessed. Things aren't that bad. The world isn't ending. None of this is new. It's just apocalypticism.
What?
I researched it for my podcast.
What is a podcast?
You didn't figure out how to end this intro, did you?
No. Happy 150th?
I'm Mindy.
And I'm Darren.
And we are the Rance Macabre, covering all things horror.
With every episode, we explore the genre with sharp focus and deep production.
We want you to love scary movies as much as we do, so we don't overshare plots or give spoilers.
Hello and welcome back, listeners.
Yeah.
This is a big moment.
Special episode.
Yeah, we've hit 150
yes.
episodes.
But then you were telling me that's not exactly true.
Not exactly.
Because there was an episode we try not to talk about.
We kind of disavow. It's up. It's available for listening. The Tragic Tale of Dick Shark, which was our punishment for a former Save Horror March Madness loss. That might have been the Halloween matchup.
Oh,
but
maybe.
In any case, we did not count that episode. As
no.
funny as it is, we did take our commentary from our punishment movie, Dick Shark, and sort of compile a best of moments.
I hate that we even kind of talk about it, because like to even say it out loud gives it power that I would like to take back. Thank you.
I've re-listened to that episode. It's pretty funny. So like, yeah, it's making lemonade out of lemons.
But it's just not getting rotten lemons.
Yeah, well, so we didn't count that one as a proper episode. This one, however, this is 150. We're calling it 150. And we were going to have some fun with this sort of bookend idea that that it could all come to an end anytime now. That, I guess, is a grim thought.
We are
gonna
is grim when sort you put it that way.
We're going to sort of look at it through our own fun, skewed sense, and we chose a couple movies that actually make light of the apocalypse.
That's true.
And, or, well, in one case, we will make light of their apocalypse in the yes. case of The Happening.
I think they're making light themselves of their sad, sad apocalypse.
Inadvertently.
So, like, 150, you know, people are never married that long because we don't live that long. but, like, what would the thing be? You know how, like, paper,
150,
gold?
Ash.
Excellent.
What else?
Petrified wood for you.
So on the theme of Armageddon, we've found some details, some historical bits and pieces. It seems mankind has been obsessed with the subject of the end times since our beginning times, it seems.
It seems that way.
Older than a number of theologies.
It's pretty crazy. The thing that kind of like makes me kind of chuckle a little bit is like, I mean, people have been talking about the end of time since the very beginning, but when people put a date on it, that's when we...
It's a gamble.
That's like next level, like you're really sure of some shit you just pulled out of your ass.
You remember 2012, there were a lot of people with like, you know, getting rid of their things, like probably racking up credit. Like they were expecting 2012, thanks to the Mayans.
They did.
And an unfinished... unspecific calendar, 2012 is what they had their eye on, even though
people really did,
like, not for nothing, but 2012 is the Christian calendar. We just celebrated the Jewish New Year,
right?
And it's closer to 6,000 years.
Yeah, it's a completely different number.
So yeah, numerology in original texts, it's
that's the joy of the whole thing, is like it's all kind of neither here nor there, but we have the first kind of like written down, hey guys, the world's gonna end in the year 66 to 70. That's when we first get some people being like,
started,
guys,
coming to a close,
this is gonna happen. And then obviously that didn't, and then people just throughout the years have been like, I don't know, it's the confidence that you have to have.
It takes a lot of ego to think that like your generation's going to be the last.
And many, many people have done this. Some women get in on it too. Don't you worry. It's not all just
fair play.
Men. You'd think maybe it would be all men because of that just assuredness.
And I think it also probably requires enough of a following for, you know, whatever cult leader to be taken seriously.
Right.
And, you know, the like machismo, ego driven, follow me, I'm the right cult kind
exactly.
of sensibility. Yeah, generally skews male.
Yeah. We also see these big times of predicting the end of the world when there's certain like upheavals going on. So in the rise of spiritualism in the late 1800s mm-hmm. and mid 1800s in America, you see another rise of people saying the world's gonna end. Oh, it just happens okay. like that. And think about
since the advent of sandwich boards and crazy messages written
exactly.
on them.
Exactly. So there's this woman, her name was Harriet Livermore, and she actually was a 19th century preacher, and she twice predicted the end of the world.
She gets a mulligan.
You'd think, like, after the first one, just be quiet, be cool, you know?
Yeah, well, or you double down and you kind of, you know, you come back out like, I checked the math.
That's
you
what,
know
what I
they
like
say,
to do.
Measure twice.
You know, that's what I like to do. When I say something like wrong or like fucked up, I like to really right. drive it home again.
You're right. Let me finish.
Yes. I like to continue being awkward. Thank you. Yeah, so she did it not once, but twice. Jim Jones, obviously, big into the world.
Just the once.
Just the once, and I guess he was right for those people. Pat Robertson has done it.
Why not?
And he has a TV platform to share the shit. Like, it's on... It's
the
like
700
recorded.
Club.
Like, oh. if I would say something crazy, I would not want it recorded, because then I'd be like, no, I didn't say that. That wasn't me.
Yeah,
I said this
but,
other day.
But he's preaching. He's got a sermon.
That's true. Jerry Falwell has also done it.
It's pretty, well, like you said, in terms of certain world circumstances feeding into the idea that, yeah, it looks like it's all coming to a close.
Yeah.
Like things are going to escalate and fall apart. Yeah, I could see. I mean, Pat Robertson, he blamed 9/11 on like lesbians
yeah,
and gay
like
marriage
gay people
and,
for some reason.
Yeah, so it always looks like the end of the world for Pat Robertson.
It's true.
I mean, if you look at him, yeah, he looks like doomsday incarnate. Like he's kind of
fingers crossed. And then there's Harold Camping, one of my favorite doomsday
okay, who
apocalyptic people.
Lead.
Which also PS this is called apocalypticism.
I like that.
Yeah.
Maybe that's the name of the episode.
Well, there you go. Check that off.
Bam.
Very cool. Sometimes, though, apocalypticism is really deeply rooted in Catholicism oftentimes and different spiritualism. A lot of people use it to propel anti-Semitic things as well.
That's
interestingly
a weird way to
enough.
Take that.
Yeah, okay. It's a very interesting, when you start digging in, I was like, this is scary, I don't like this.
I don't know, it's a potential tangent that I won't go into, but there is a weird subsect of ultra-Christian leaders who believe that what? That Israel needs to be in charge of, I forget the name of the hill and the territory, but like Israel needs to be in control of all this territory
because
for Jesus to come back.
Right.
It's a whole thing.
Yeah, there's a lot we could get into on that. And that's interesting and crazy. But let's get back to Harold Camping since we're talking about interesting and crazy.
Please.
He is one of my favorites because he had a radio show and he shared these crazy, crazy thoughts, had a huge following.
I remember getting a flyer for his radio sermons. I remember getting a flyer in Times Square.
Very popular fella.
Yeah.
So popular that even my husband Jackson worked at a store and one of the luthiers was a Harold Camping listener and literally thought the world was going to end when Harold Camping said it was in 2011.
Did he start like selling his guitars and things?
He sold a lot of things. He really thought it was the end of the world.
When things start looking grim, that's when I start charging all my expenses. That's
just keep
fuck
swiping.
Fuck my credit.
It's the end of the world. Just keep swiping. Yeah, this guy, really kind of a crazy fella because a lot of people sold a lot of things.
I'm just saying otherwise because doomsday preppers and the other type, like, hey, if you're going to be around after Ascension Day, you know.
Well, the doomsday prepper,
keep supplies handy.
He or they, I suppose, the doomsday prepper, they're really wanting to bank on the fact that they're still going to be there. They're not getting raptured. They're going to be there. So lots of these people make these crazy assumptions that it's going to be the end of the world. There's actually academic journal writings on this, tons of stuff. And in 2015, in the Sociology of Religion, someone wrote an article which was essentially rationalizing Judgment Day. And it was how these people throughout history have rationalized how they got it wrong. And all these people use these same kind of four tenets to say, this is how I got it wrong. It's essentially the four rules of the oopsie poopsie.
It's like PR for cult leaders.
Number one, they're going to use spiritualization, which means that the prediction was accurate, but it's in a spiritual way. So the world
we can't hear it.
Exactly. Which is lovely. That's a great, I want to use that for all my things that I get
I'm
wrong.
I'm sorry I was late for class. In fact, I was on time.
I was actually here.
You just couldn't see me or hear me.
Yeah. They'll use this other thing, the reasoning called test of faith. And that essentially is the fact that because you weren't faithful enough, we didn't get to end of the world.
Oh, throwing it back on the members.
It's all about throwing it back and throwing deflecting.
Wow, that's
you could
ballsy.
Use this in
that's
your real life. These.
Yeah, really.
Number three.
I would have been on time if you all had hoped and wished and really focused on me being on
time.
Yeah,
you just didn't pray hard enough.
Who among you, who was it, who didn't think I was going to get here on time?
Exactly. It's now your you're fault. Getting it. Now you're getting it, man. Number three, human error. But it's not usually the error of the person. It's the error, again, of the people.
I'm going to fire my secretary.
Exactly. It's someone else's fault. Maybe the pages were wrong in the book because Harold Camping really liked to use numbers to prove his things that were not real. And so then it was like, oh, well, when I translated this, it was actually translated thusly and things like that. And then number four is always a great one when you're scheming, blaming others.
All right. That's a go-to. You don't need to be in a doomsday cult. You just politically, just blame others.
But I think, you know, like, hey, I could use those four things in my whole life.
They should incorporate this into the a guide to making friends and influencing people.
Yeah, it's an addendum to Dale Carnegie. This is from an article, though, that's a really interesting read called Rationalizing Judgment Day, a content analysis of Harold Camping's open forum program. That's about his radio show. And you know, there's four religious scholars that write this article. And it's very fun because they're religious scholars, But they see the bullshit in the whole thing.
That's a fascinating lens of theology to look through and go like, well, this is what end of the world nuts have in common. So if memory serves, in Judaism, the alphabet also coincides with numbers, and that feeds into a numerological study of the Old Testament. However, in Judaism, there is no term for Armageddon, but there are references in the Hebrew Bible to events that could be compared with Armageddon. This is where there would be a war between Gog and Magog, in which Israel and its God fight their enemies, rather than the traditional Antichrist showdown.
Oh.
Yeah, I don't know. The Old Testament's got some pretty wacky stuff. So branching from there into Christianity, some Christians interpret the Book of Revelation as a roadmap that lays out exactly how the world will end. They contend that Judgment Day will take place on Armageddon, and Jesus will save the true believers, while non-believers left behind will face enormous suffering, and Kirk Cameron is going to look down and laugh and laugh and laugh at us. So as we venture into the subject of doomsday cults and that more grim subject matter, we're also going to be talking about a couple more fun movies that are apocalypse-themed.
Yeah. Why not have fun at the end of the world?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of my philosophy. I'm not a religious person of any sort, so I kind of figure like, hey, the odds were against us being here in the first place. Let's just celebrate being here in its entirety.
Right.
Nothing would really change if I saw the end. It's just still
I wouldn't
kinda
go to work. Well, sure. Actually, I probably would. I love my job now.
Well, the way you described it, the end times is going to be like 100 years long, so you still got to feed yourself.
That's
like,
true. Do I
mean, unless you want to become your own cult member and then just have people show up with food and whatnot.
You know, I met Jackson, something he's always wanted to do, he always talked about, was starting a cult. He really always wanted to start a cult. Isn't that weird? He's not like a scheming person. He's a very nice person, but it's something he's always wanted to do.
I wonder if the incentive of like essentially having other people care for your needs.
Uh-huh.
I wonder if that actually turns out to be more work than it's worth.
It seems like a lot of effort.
You got to trademark a name. You've got to start a website. It's like starting a podcast.
Right.
It's a lot of work. All right. So jumping into the films we'll be covering, we are going to be opening with Edgar Wright's The World's End from 2013. And we're going to be in between that. You guys will hear our sort of, again, our best of commentary for The Happening, the M. Night Shyamalan, yes, Mark Wahlberg dud. And we're going to be finishing up with This Is the End, the Seth Rogen, Evan Goldberg joint, pun intended.
Ever have one of those nights that starts out like any other but ends up being the best night of your life?
Are you sitting comfortably? Then we'll begin.
It was June the 22nd, 1990, our final day of school. There was Oliver Chamberlain, Peter Page, Stephen Prince, Andy Knightley, and me. They called me the King because my name's Gary King.
Enter part three and the conclusion of the Cornetto trilogy. So for those who don't know, Cornetto ice creams appear in each of Edgar Wright's movies. Here, to a lesser degree, I think we just get the wrapper. But each movie features a different flavor and color combination of the Cornetto. There's a red Cornetto in Shaun of the Dead from 2004 and a blue one in Hot Fuzz in 2007. And the green Cornetto makes its appearance here during the epilogue of this movie. Incidentally, so does the Ooh-Ah Dracula fruit slot machine. That's in all of his movies as well.
Oh, that's interesting.
So, The World's End, directed by Edgar Wright and co-written by Wright and Simon Pegg, with a huge cast of English regulars.
Everyone who's everyone. Obviously, Simon Pegg is there. Nick Frost is obviously there because I feel like they can't. They're together.
He's the best thing about this movie, I thought.
I love Simon Pegg. I think he's really, really funny. We have Martin Freeman. He's in there. God, I hate Martin Freeman.
You really?
No, I like him in this movie, though. I just can't stand him in this movie.
Oh, okay.
Like,
I've kind of, I made the mistake of like hearing a bad thing and then checking into it. And like Martin Freeman outside of the films is not such an awesome guy.
Really?
Yeah. But he's, it's like he's mandatory in every English film. It's like
he's
Bilbo
Baggins.
Yeah. And they won't finance an English movie unless Martin Freeman has at least a cameo in it.
I suppose that's true. Then we have Eddie Marsan. He's Peter. And Rosamund Pike is in it. And I love her.
Yeah, from Gone Girl. And but also Pierce Brosnan's got a cameo.
Yes, he does.
Yeah, and some other
cameos. The voice of Bill Nye, he makes an impression here. It's always good to hear him. I would like to see him, too. I love him.
Yeah, he's great. He's great. Okay, so a brief synopsis before we jump right in. Five friends who reunite in an attempt to top their epic pub crawl from 20 years earlier unwittingly become humanity's only hope for survival. Now, that kind of puts it out there, but it's also a little bit of a misdirection. They're mostly dragged into this,
yes,
into this night out. And so, yeah, the movie does follow Simon Pegg's character, Gary King, who, even in the flashbacks, these are not like the height of coolness in terms of their high school group.
No, but in their mind, they think they're cooler than they are, which I think everyone flips things around and you're like, I was much cooler than I really was, probably.
Yeah, I was thinking it either goes that way or, I mean, there's a huge contingent of people, I'm kind of in the middle, who like, high school sucked. Like, those were not the glory days.
Oh, no.
And that theme plays out here in terms of the rose-colored glasses, that Gary King, those are the glory days. And I think we've all encountered the types of like, oh, high school, those were the best years of my life.
Well, it's always that Al Bundy, you know, so many touchdowns for whatever his high school was.
Common in townies, it seems. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. And this is, I mean, Gary is the townie to beat all townies, really.
Yeah, although he's seemingly lost a lot of time because, like, here they are in their presumably late 30s. The age discrepancy among the group also
seems a little shifty.
Sense.
Yeah, because isn't Martin Freeman, like, 50-something?
He's probably at least in his late 40s.
Yeah.
Yeah, so all these guys are,
it's hard to tell when they're
ballparking.
English, because some of the English people look really young and some of them get really old really fast. This started to me very similar, well, I suppose this other movie started similar to this, which The Ritual, it reminds me of dragging friends into this drinking thing that they just don't want to do.
I guess in the original flashbacks, they didn't all make it for the whole trip, and so it's not even a complete story in terms of like reliving the glory days. It's like reenacting and then trying to improve upon. But again, like Gary King is just stuck in the past.
Right.
And his character, I think it works because it's Simon Pegg. You get the sense that like he is very quick and clever and funny for a teenager. Like that shit is a lot less charming when you're in your late 30s.
Yeah.
And so that kind of, you get more and more of that as the story goes along. But it also, and minor spoiler, like we are kind of on an adventure of an alcoholic's like spiral. I don't know. It's like what's like a fun spiral has negative connotations, but for him, like this is like a fun spiral. Let's drag
the last
everybody
blast
along with
kind
him.
Of thing.
Yeah, yeah. I guess that's more of it. Yeah.
It really is, and I think there's in his character and in the way that Simon Pegg does it, which is a good thing it's Simon Pegg and not somebody else. There's this desperation that lives right on top of everything else that he's doing. And it's just like shadows everything he does. He's desperate to get these friends together. He's desperate for attention. He's desperate for Rosamund Pike when he, you know, encounters her again. He's desperate to be young again. And it's so sad.
That desperation, whereas any number of us would kind of fall into a depression and just kind of decide, like, I don't even feel like getting out of bed anymore.
It keeps him hungry.
He goes the manic route.
Yeah.
And that is kind of like his state through most of the movie. Like, we are on board for a manic episode of grand proportions.
Right.
And his friends are, I mean, he's manipulated his way. Like, everyone, there wasn't a single, like, enthused, voluntary member of that group. They all need to be manipulated into going on this World's End pub crawl.
Like, you have Andy, who I feel at any time, like, the wrong thing could be said, and then it's a fist fight going to break out.
So Andy's bitterness can be sort of tracked back, and we do get the full story, but there was obviously a huge fracturing between Gary and Andy, Nick Frost and Simon Pegg, and they have not spoken since whatever pivotal tragedy.
Right.
And Andy's holding a grudge, and he's also owed money. That helps. And so when Gary is manipulating his way into getting Andy to come, that money gets paid. But once Andy's on board, now we're off to the races. I will say the flashback, like, it all starts on the like glory days explanation, and it very quickly becomes apparent that we are in a group therapy session, and Simon Pegg is explaining all this, and just sitting next to him is Bloody Mary from Shaun of the Dead.
Nice.
Yeah, she's a recognizable face, and I think she's essentially doing the same, like, dead-eyed, at least I hope she is. I hope I'm just not Aww. Just making fun of this actress. But she looks like Bloody Mary, who was in The Yard in Shaun of the Dead.
Newton Haven was our hometown, our playground, our universe, and that night it was the site of a heroic quest. The aim? To conquer the Golden Mile. 12 pubs along a legendary path of alcoholic indulgence. There was the First Post, the Old Familiar, the Famous Cock, the Cross Hands, the Good Companions, the Trusty Servant, the Two-Headed Dog, the Mermaid, the Beehive, the King's Head, the Hole in the Wall, all before reaching our destiny, the World's End.
As Simon Pegg is bringing the group together and he's recruiting Martin Freeman, we do get a brief cameo by Rafi Spall, who is one of the couple who's looking to buy a house. And he has been in all Edgar Wright's movies up to this point. He's the sales boy in Shaun of the Dead. He's one of the Detective Andes in Hot Fuzz. And recently we saw him in The Ritual, which we both loved.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think because it was a Netflix movie, you kind of treat it like any number of binging things where you see it, you're like, wow, that was impressive. You recommend it to a few friends and then you move on. It's tough to like keep fanfare for a really good flick, but The Ritual, still on Netflix, yeah. Huge, like, really good movie. Really,
I know, like, and I brought it up because it starts very similar to this. It's like friends who don't want to be with each other. you know?
Yeah, I think we've all got friends who are kind of just along for the ride because they have been along for the ride for all these years. Yeah.
And so our journey into manhood began. We were off. We didn't waste any time. We hit pub one, and we hit it hard. There was drinking, there was fun, there was controversy, there were ladies, there were shots, there was drama, and of course, there was drinking. By pub five, we were feeling invincible and decided to purchase some herbal refreshment from a man we called the Reverend Green. Pint six put O-Man out of commission, so we carried on without him. Good thing. I bumped into his sister in the next pub. We went into the Disabled, and I bumped into her again. Sam tagged along for a while, but then I had to let her go. I had another date that night, and her name was Amber. Nine pints in, and it was us against the world. Things got mental in the Beehive, so we repaired to the Bowls Club, or as we like to call it, the Smokehouse, which is when it all went fuck up. Everyone got power and Pete chucked a whitey, so we had to bench him. In the end, we blew off the last three pubs and headed for the hills. I remember sitting up there, blood on my knuckles, beer down my shirt, sick on my shoes, seeing the orange glow of a new dawn break and knowing in my heart life would never feel this good again. And you know what? It never did.
Thank you, Gary. That was very enlightening.
So the reason the friends are getting together is because they're going on this epic bar crawl, essentially. And they have to get through all of the bars, which they've never done. And they've built this up to be some great big thing. So we see them as they go from bar to bar. In the second bar, they pick up Rosamund Pike. That's where she comes and joins the party.
Yeah, she's the sister of Martin Freeman's character.
Right. And Gary has this thing for her. In the third bar, Gary's not even allowed in because he's been banned. But it still counts that he drinks there because he drinks some beer that's outside.
Yeah.
It's really revolting.
I think that's
sad.
I think we definitely realize up to this point that, like, he's dealing with his own demons in, you know, unhealthy ways.
When you're willing to drink, like, beer that's just sitting outside.
Yeah.
Who knows what's in there? Probably cigarette butts.
Oh, gross. Or slugs. That's, ew. Well, when you leave beer outside.
Slugs?
Yeah.
Where do you live with slugs?
The suburbs.
Oh.
Or snails. I said slugs. What's the difference between a slug and a snail?
Slug doesn't have a shell. So that counts, and you can check off. They can check off the third bar. The fourth bar, it starts to get a little, things get a little heated.
Simon Pegg's character is so much on his own mission that, like, yeah, I don't know. It again, I don't know that it would work if it was anybody other than Simon Pegg, because it's not inherently depressing.
It's one of those characters that in the 90s Vince Vaughn would play. You know, like the Swingers era Vince Vaughn.
Yeah, I could see that.
And like, but Vince Vaughn would irritate you. And Simon Pegg, you just go, God damn it. You know, it's not as awful.
He's still like quick on his feet and funny.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there's a lot of wordplay. It's a pretty tight script. Like
it
every conversation.
So much of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Okay.
He reminds me so much, especially at the very end of the film, of the character Ford Prefect, because Ford can talk his way in and out of everything. Mm-hmm. And that's how I feel like Simon Pegg, the same thing, is his ability to talk and move words around.
Yeah, and there's a theatricality to it. Mm-hmm. Like he behaves as if he's on camera every moment. Like every bar that they walk into, he is the king.
He's
returned,
the star.
And he makes a scene and he demands his attention. And that's I'm saying it out loud. That is an exhausting person to be around.
Yes.
And so he's so self-centered that in the fourth bar, when they have their sit down, and because it is a towny bar and you know, these guys are local. Well, they were at one time. And the one of the guys, the baby of the group, his bully is present and accounted for and recognizable. And so when that guy comes up to grab a seat and doesn't even recognize the kid that he tortured in high school, they have like that really like solemn moment where he's like really vulnerable and just like vocal about what he went through. And Gary is off like getting shots. Like he's not listened to any of this. He's just kind of solved this problem with what he solves everything with, liquor.
Right.
But yeah, that moment, especially now where we talk about bullying a lot more openly and it's kind of addressed as like a social problem. Like here we get a look at like what a lifelong toll it takes. And this guy has like been haunted by this.
Right.
And that his bully never gave him a second thought.
Right.
It's so sad in that moment. It's really, I don't know. And then we get into the bathroom.
Yes. We get into this bathroom scene, and that is where I would say the movie starts. Really,
yeah.
Really starts. Because Gary, oh, it's a pathetic fight. It's there's a line from the rapper The Streets where he says it's never gonna be the Jackie Chan scene you thought it was gonna be. And that is how this fight goes.
Yeah, so the movie does, like, this is the movie changes modes a couple times, and this is the first time it shifts into something else. And what I find really fun in the movie is that, exemplified in the fight scenes, it kind of does become this rose-colored glasses, where the fights start out, like, sloppy and very sort of, like, professional wrestling. I actually recognize that there are two trademark moves from The Rock that are in this movie.
Nice.
There's the People's Elbow and the Rock Bottom, and they're both like slow-mo big air action shots. But the movie kind of does escalate where it starts on this, you know, sort of crude level, and then by the end of it, it is Jackie Chan and Drunken Master. Like, it's pretty fantastic.
Right. So in an effort not to spoil this, because if you haven't seen it, you need to, right?
Yes,
it's a film you need to see. So I'm not going to spoil it, but in this scene, that's when we start to discover everything is not what it seems, and everyone is not what they seem.
Yeah, when you go back to your hometown and everything is exactly how it was, you should be suspicious. But
I don't know. I am from a very small town where nothing ever changes.
Oh, yeah.
Well, okay. So maybe this is the case. I don't know. I haven't gotten into any fights to tell.
People live this every day without even noticing. I thought Nick Frost is, like, he's showing the acting chops. Like, my memory, and I won't go into the deep dive, but, like, these guys have been together since the show Space that Simon Pegg and Jessica Hines wrote and starred in and Edgar Wright directed. There's even a fun, like, precursor to Shaun of the Dead in that show. And I would just, you know, for a nerdy moment, say that if you can find it, the Blu-ray for the American release of Space has a bunch of really cool commentaries where, like, everybody from Patton Oswalt to Quentin Tarantino to Kevin Smith do, like, watch-alongs with Edgar Wright. Anyway, that's a great show. Nick Frost wasn't one of the, like, improv troupe sketch comedy guys. He was a waiter at a bar pub that they would all visit, and here are a bunch of people who are professionally funny, right. And Nick Frost is keeping up with them and just, like, organically becomes one of the group and then enters into the show Space, and he's been a star ever since. This is the first place, although I did watch the weird, like, dancing movie he made a while ago. I don't remember the name of it, but Nick Frost, like, is showing some acting chops. Okay. Like, there's some drama. There's, you know, a well-rounded character here. That said, when he starts drinking, he becomes the funniest person in this movie to me. Like, the movie's got a lot of, like, kind of, you know, funny moments that you're looking at, like, oh, that was clever. But Nick Frost is the only person who made me laugh out loud.
So, as they go on this journey, we also see someone who I feel like every town had one of these, like the crazy guy who just happens to be around.
Our crazy guy ran for mayor.
Really?
Yeah.
That's exciting.
Big Mike. Rest in peace, Big Mike.
Oh, that's adorable. Did he win?
No. No, he did not. Oh. He did not win the rec center basketball games he participated in, nor did he win the run for mayor.
But he tried, no. And that's what counts.
He sure did.
Oh, shit, look who it is. Basil. My Basil. Do you remember we used to come in here and listen to him talk about fucking UFOs and lizard people and underwater Nazis?
He
and
some bullshit about the Bermuda Triangle actually being a square. No, he said it was two isosceles triangles forming a rhombus.
He was your best mate, wasn't he, Steve?
No, he wasn't my best mate, Gary. He was a lowly old guy and I felt a bit sorry for him.
That's right. Basil!
Yeah, he's the unintelligible local in Hot Fuzz with the huge armory. Yeah, and here he's got a crazy straw at the bar. Like, he's a funny, funny actor.
I think our local one would probably be my Uncle Scott.
That's awesome.
where everyone thinks he's charming in his half-witticism, but those of us related do not find it as charming.
Was he known for, like, the occasional public spectacle? Why was he?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah?
No, it's always a public spectacle. we have a saying, like, he will give anyone the shirt off his back because it was someone else's shirt.
And he that will give is anyone him. Their shirt back.
And that is him.
You got me. You got
and
me.
So
I guess I'm going home
the
cold.
Local... The local fascination.
That's fun.
Now, I certainly know how the Kennedys feel being related to that spectacle.
So, yeah, as the movie goes along, it's kind of like we're getting drunk with them.
Yeah.
Because the world starts looking the way it used to. And I think because the characters are hammered, they're not picking out that, like, something is way off. Instead, they're just kind of being catered to and going along with it. And in that way, the movie kind of, you know, we've talked about it shifting modes. It sort of plays with Stepford Wives themes and a little bit we're coming into Invasion of the Body Snatcher themes. And yeah, I really love that about Edgar Wright films, that he has written the hell out of them. And here we do get the third installment of the fence gag from Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz. That's a nice sort of cap.
Yes.
I wonder if Edgar Wright and Simon Pegg at this point are just happy to move on from a couple of the tropes that they've been sort of
working
into the
movies. I don't know, or maybe it's just a lovely, like...
It's like coming back home.
Yeah.
Which is the theme. So it is an Edgar Wright jam. There's tons of Easter eggs throughout the movie. In true Simon Pegg style, there is foreshadowing in the bar's names that he discusses and in the conversations early in the movie, the images mirrored between the opening and closing. Like, Edgar Wright makes beautifully symmetrical films. I kind of like that. Like, it speaks to the pre-planning. The poster of the movie apparently borrows the image and some of the name from the 1977 film End of the World with Christopher Lee. I had never heard of it, but it's about a man who witnesses a death in a bizarre accident. Father Purgato, he goes on a spiritual retreat where he encounters his alien double bent on world conquest.
Oh,
that took a turn. But I mean, this movie similarly kind of shifts tone and direction a number of times, so it's a nice kind of nod to that. And I guess we'll leave it there in terms of not spoiling big elements of The World's End. The next whiskey bar, I tell you we must die. Okay, so from The World's End, you guys will now hear us go into our audio commentary for The Happening.
We're going to wish the world ended.
Before this fucking movie came out. although, I mean, I remember distinctly the trailer for The Happening was
dope. I thought
dope.
It was going to be really good.
It looks
great. Do you remember we were in lunch at the place we used to work? And I had actually gotten into a fight with one of our friends. I don't remember what I did that was so wrong.
I do remember.
And I said, oh, I'm going to go see The Happening tonight with my other friend. And this friend who was mad at me told me the secret.
Yeah.
And I was like, what a bitch move.
I mean, it's really tough to put your finger on when and where M. Night Shyamalan jumped the shark. Lady in the Water did not help his cause.
I never saw that one.
I've still not seen it either.
Nope, no
I've seen
need.
Pieces. But The Happening was really the biggest like switcheroo in terms of going into the film with expectations and then fuck your expectations. We're going to do something shitty.
Well, what was that Adrian Brody movie?
The Village.
Yeah, that was bad.
I liked most of The Village. Like 3/4 of The Village I liked. I couldn't say I liked 3/4 of The Happening.
No, I liked 0/4. Is that a number? 0/4.
So yeah, so coming up, you will be hearing in the theme of our unnumbered episode, Dick Shark, we will be chopping together our best of commentary for The Happening, and hopefully that has some entertainment value.
Hooray!
So throughout the movie, I'm puzzled by everybody's motivations. Maybe some of them thought they were in a comedy. Maybe, I mean, that could lend to the confusing looks everybody gives each other that, like, what movie are you in?
You're in this too? Okay.
The whole opening credits, the clouds moving backwards and dissolving one into the other, it kind of looks like it happened after the movie was made and the studio was like, you don't get any more money, M. Night. We're done throwing money away at this problem.
Choose a screensaver and write with Word on top of it. Jackson always says you can tell the quality of a film by the font.
And this construction site is already... No, these guys are having their coffee at 9 a.m. These guys are not working in the city before 9 a.m.
That's not true, because the people who run the jackhammer outside of my house when they were doing construction work out there would start that shit at like 8 o'clock in the morning. Oop, there goes a body.
That guy was not wearing his hard hat. Or maybe he was.
Maybe he was, but it's not designed. Yeah.
It's not a helmet. It's a hard hat.
Oop, there goes another body. I would get under the scaffolding.
Yeah, this is the look. The people coming off of the top of the building.
I mean, it's great. This starts out great. You think all sorts of good things are going to happen. And then nothing good happens.
And then we cut to Mark Wahlberg as a science teacher.
He's in a teacher.
He's wearing a sweater vest. Mark Wahlberg as a science teacher is an oxymoron. It's like Danny DeVito is Don Juan. Donald Trump is president. And then Mark Wahlberg's the cool teacher because he's hiding from the vice principal. I have to interrupt you. You're not a science teacher. This is going poorly.
You've got to stop.
You're bad at this. It's your last day. Pack up your shit.
Okay, I love John Leguizamo.
Me too.
Not in this movie.
No.
People are comforted by percentages. Are they?
He's also doing that thing where he talks like he's got a lot of water or spit in his mouth and you want him to swallow it.
It's giving him like an inadvertent lisp.
Yeah, I don't care for that. That's how I feel about like Zach de la Roja too.
Oh.
He reminds me of like Brack from the Brack show from Space Ghost. Like your teeth are too much in your mouth.
Less teeth. Less teeth in your mouth.
Less teeth, less spit.
Okay, this is the first place that we're giving exposition that Mark Wahlberg and his wife are not really hitting it off lately. Although he brings it up to John Leguizamo. And when John Leguizamo starts asking questions, he's like, don't worry about it. It's private.
And the machine gun delivery of how this is all going. It's almost like David Mamet, but not.
Why does everybody keep saying that about my wife, with whom I don't get along? All right, it's a real gamble to be someone's friend and tell them that, like, I don't like your wife. I don't think she's good for you.
Yeah, you never say that because your friends will always stay together.
Yeah. Cut to Zooey Deschanel's giant eyes staring just slightly off camera. She's actually a Disney character come to life. She's getting a call from Joe or Joey.
Joey.
That she is ignoring. She's just letting vibrate and go to
She seems voicemail. Neurotic?
She's
staring or maybe
at
that's her,
phone
her eyes. I just don't know.
I actually really like Zooey Deschanel. I think I've watched every Netflix episode of New Girl.
I want to slap you in the face. But that's what this movie does to you. It tells you literally what the secret is and then walks it back.
This translation is still a little more calm than I would expect, like on a day of terrorism.
No, because like I've been to Penn Station on a day of not terrorism, and it fucking sucks. Maybe in Philadelphia people are nicer.
No.
It's the city of brotherly love.
that's a misnomer. This is the same city that threw batteries at football games, who threw like ice balls at Santa Claus. Philly has some rough clientele.
It's hard to please.
And I don't know how John Leguizamo, with his fucking New Yorkiest accent, is supposed to be a transplant to Philly.
Well, that's the same thing with the Southie and Wahlberg.
Yeah, I guess there's no escaping that either. He plays up the high pitch element of his voice in this movie, I think, to try and appear more nerdy. I think that's his best effort to, like, maybe I'm not from Boston. Maybe it's anyone's guess.
He does do that soft talking kind of thing.
He's a whisper talker in this movie for sure.
I don't care for that. I wish it would have been on a track, though, because it's very, like, literally a person is walking backwards right now with the camera.
Oh, that would be a fun meta moment if they pull back even further, show the camera guy. He puts down the camera, picks up the gun, shoots himself.
That's too clever.
He's like, it's all for you, M. Night. It's all for you.
All
that
right.
was good and creepy.
Yeah, but then the rest of the movie's here.
Here, Zooey Deschanel is finally having a conversation with Joey.
The writing is so bad. We ate tiramisu together. That's it. You've got to chill out.
Did like, Joey when forget normal- she needed to remind him of the one good time we had that you were clearly obsessing over?
Human beings don't speak like this.
Unless when she tells him, we ate tiramisu, it was just that one time. Unless tiramisu is code for ass, that doesn't make any sense. They should not be that connected. All right, that's a little bit of eye acting. Mark Wahlberg wasn't terrible in that moment. But then they get off the train, and then the acting gets real good.
What is happening right now? Mark Wahlberg's seemingly looking at his hand.
Mark Wahlberg is got the mood ring in frame. I think it's going to come up. It's coming off the finger.
Okay, good thing he brought that.
Everyone gives off energy. He's a science teacher. It's like Mark Wahlberg is telling her about an episode of The X-Files that he saw.
He's like, this is science.
And this magic
ring. I saw it on Ancient Aliens.
Mark Wahlberg was probably given a couple mood rings over the course of his career that, like, hey, man, you're pretty shit at emoting. Maybe let's get a visual aid on you to help you out. All right, this is insane. This woman who they had not shared a word before this woman gets his attention. It's first generation iPhone. She shows him a snuff film, a video of a guy at the zoo in the tiger cage, and he's about to be taken apart. Yep, there we go.
There he goes. It's not even, like, well filmed. Hold the camera straight. Also, in the first generation iPhone, they would have held it up and down like a bunch of assholes because people filmed shittily then. Yeah,
people
and it
still
sucked.
Film shittily. World star. Yeah. This woman essentially showed him a world star snuff video. But, like, he didn't ask to see a video. She's just like, hey, stranger.
Want to see someone die? We had a coworker who did that to me one time, and I was like, never show me a video like that ever again.
Oh, no. What was it?
It was a man on the third rail.
Oh, God. He wasn't chasing after anybody. He said, hey, to a car that was already 50 yards away, moving at a pretty good clip.
Where's John Leguizamo right now?
He's procuring a ride from Dante from Clerks. That line was designed to be said as the car was already out of frame. But Mark Wahlberg, not really on his cues.
Not at all. Everything's on such a delay. He's like, I just want to get out of this movie. This is my exit, guys.
I've got 100% chance of getting the fuck out of this movie if I leave now. He's dressed like a gym coach.
So he's one of the, you know, a lot of times math teachers are also like coaches.
Okay. That makes sense. He could be track coach / math teacher.
Do you think he would be a track coach or a baseball coach or?
No,
I would not say football. He's too small.
M. Night's a little literal. If he was a baseball coach, he'd be wearing a baseball hat.
Yeah, I'm surprised he doesn't have a whistle.
Mark Wahlberg, I'm a little surprised they didn't force glasses on him. He is a science teacher after all.
I'm surprised.
Leguizamo gets the glasses.
Well, they don't want to hide.
All right, that they didn't shoot in slow-mo, but they did like a step process to slow it down.
I don't like that. It makes me think I had a stroke every time I see something like that.
And this guy's got a dope-ass greenhouse.
That's a nice greenhouse.
You would think this guy with his green thumb would be friends of the plants, that they would kind of cut him some slack, but...
Plants are no one's friend.
All right. That's right. This guy obsesses with hot dogs.
I don't mind hot dogs.
But who loves hot dogs? You know what? Betty Toxic loves a hot dog. I think it's as much as on her profile.
I don't mind them. I get that they're gross, but I don't mind them.
John Leguizamo knows people are comforted by statistics, so he's
gonna give someone a riddle. You know what I would do with that? Tell him to shut the fuck up.
He's presenting a math problem to someone having a panic attack. That's a good way to give me a panic attack.
I know. That does not calm me down. Nothing about this situation. Dante, he don't like what's going on here.
And that's the first time we've gotten a look at him. Like, he's a recognizable face, especially to, like, New Jersey Kevin Smith Allegiant.
Well, that's why he's going to New Jersey, I assume. Oh, that's too bad. They're all going to die. Now, are they going to drive backwards?
That would be kind of funny.
Because it's a bitch, too, because it's a stick shift.
Nope. Oh, shit.
Oh, they're driving forward.
Oh, and Dante flies out the front of the window after driving straight into a truck.
Put your fucking seatbelt on, everybody. Well, someone from the backseat flew out, too, because two people flew out the front. So I assume Dante and then one of the guy in the back.
Randall.
Which the terrible thing was is like, and I say this to everyone in my car, you have to put your seatbelt on in my car because it's not just you I'm worried about. I don't want your body running into me. Why? Why are we stopping the car?
They saw bodies in the street.
So?
So bad sign.
I like how Mark Wahlberg gave that little girl the ring, but then apparently just took it back because it's back on his finger. Which is a dick move. It seems wrong, but every single person deserves a good slap in the face in this film. Like, everyone needs to straighten up.
They are all seemingly, like, they shared Xanax before, really.
They're sort of, though, on the edge of panic as well, though. It's like...
Zooey Deschanel is doing quiet panic. Yes. We got, like, a whisper monologue of what if it's gotten here already, which it clearly has. There's dead people on the road.
Excuse me, sir. You're a little old to be a private in the Army.
Oh, this is my favorite Mark Wahlberg acting.
Why is everyone watching this lady talk to her kid on the phone?
I think she's probably the only person with service. Okay, so this mother is talking to her daughter in Princeton. And so this panicked woman is our face to this event. everyone's dead outside. And then Mark Wahlberg is about 13 seconds late in responding. He's responding to the wrong line.
Yeah, he is.
That's
It's like
perfect.
He doesn't even know what's going on.
No, he missed his cue, but because this camera work is supposed to be like fly on the wall and moving between everybody, they never cut.
He takes her phone. He's like, I'm going to call somebody now.
My turn.
You've still got some minutes left on this phone.
Mark Wahlberg missed another cue. Now you take the phone when she is inconsolable.
Maybe it's supposed to be like that these people are like only slightly affected and that's why they're slow to do anything right.
That's like low-level contagion. People just act like dummies.
Yeah, maybe.
And Zooey Deschanel now, like for a second, was trying to comfort the traumatized little girl, but then walked away from her. Where'd Zooey Deschanel go?
I don't know.
She's really easily distracted, it seems. Like, she's not
with
Mark
Wahlberg
in the
train
station.
Because her eyes are so big, she can probably see lots of things that we can't even see.
She can see, like, an owl. She doesn't need to move her head to see 360 degrees. All right, so this is kind of cool. The idea that plants do intercommunicate, even between species. There's a really cool episode, Lab, that kind of talks about the root superhighway, that there are interconnected plants in any, you know, expansive area where they do communicate amongst themselves. I don't know. More fun factoids. This movie.
No, that is kind of cool because I often see like squirrels and what are those, like the chipmunks, and they pretend like each other don't exist.
Really?
So if like
in
different plants can like, yeah, but they don't coexist.
No.
They just are separate things. And so I think, like, if plants can get together and be friends, like, this movie is making me stupider.
She lied. She omitted eating tiramisu. Again, unless tiramisu is code for ass, she just had a dessert with a guy.
Right.
And he's been obsessed with her ever since. I guess she didn't tell Mark Wahlberg, and so a lie by omission.
Yeah, and now Mark Wahlberg is all sad.
He's heartbroken, but you could never tell.
It's just so stupid. I like how they left him just muttering to himself. They're demanding an answer from him.
They start walking
away. And they're just like, well, I didn't like that.
It's Mark Wahlberg. He's going to be processing this a while.
Let's go over there.
All right, in all fairness, like, this is the wind. This isn't the plant. Plants don't
generate
wind.
I know. So sometimes in this movie, I think, like, is it the plants or is it the wind? You know, like, what's really the culprit here?
It's the backwards moving clouds from the opening.
What kind of map is this? It's like a tourist map.
Yeah, this is like the map from the World's End with the pubs. This is a map of the Golden Mile.
Yeah. This is... There's like normal people don't use these kind of maps.
And we did get a little more exposition in terms of the plants talking to each other because Mark Wahlberg wasn't around Hot Dog Guy when he was explaining the plants talking among each. Wait, that's also a map of just green. What did we?
I know. And he's also saying, oh, that must be 10 miles. I don't think this cartoon map like is built to scale.
And what is essentially the Bluth's family home that is also the model home.
Yes.
They didn't notice this coming in?
Sort of. He had grabbed those book things.
Oh, right. There were false fronts. Yeah.
I thought it was just a bad set dressing at first. Why is this happening?
Drink
Josh
again.
Says. And I'm thinking, like, is he talking about the fact that there's not actually food on that plate or this in general? Or why is this movie happening?
He was really talking to M. Night. That Mark Wahlberg's responding, but he was asking the director, why is any of this happening? Okay, so now that they can see him from afar, you kind of get like the football color commentary. When the groups get too big, they stop. They start speaking gibberish. Some will walk backwards. Oh, this was good.
I like this. I like this a great deal.
This is, you know what? In all fairness, this was long before the movie Sinister, where the guy gets the riding mower going And in all fairness, shouldn't every riding mower have like a safety mechanism that,
yes,
like a jet ski, if you pull off with the key, it stops going.
Absolutely. Usually the riding mower, when you stand up from the chair, is the weight of the person on the chair that makes it go.
That makes all the sense in the world, except this guy just got ate by a riding mower. This fucking mood ring is a real, real conversation
Good
starter.
Good thing he brought it. We would just talk about bees all the time.
Okay, also, I get, like, being polite, but we've already established that the plants after us, and the little girl is swinging on a swing, hanging off of a giant tree branch. It's okay to tell her to get the fuck off the swing. You're going to get us all killed.
And then she's like, it's just for a minute. Calm down. Here comes my favorite scene. Yep, there it is. Watch, it's so delayed and stupid.
Mark Wahlberg responded pretty quickly to the first shotgun appearance.
I don't think anyone's getting out of this.
He's telling a kid with half a head that we're going to get out of this.
Good luck to you. Whoop, Betty Buckley does not stand for bad manners. I like how she knows that, like, proper manners would say that she has to let them spend the night, but she doesn't want to. Which I like that, because I'm a relatively polite person, and I sometimes hate it. I hate that, like, social mores say I should do the following item. And I'll do it, but begrudgingly.
The last time I was here, you had to emergency dog sit. And we all collectively watched that nervous dog sit in the middle of your carpet, pop a squat, and shit on your carpet.
That's true.
Just had to take it.
Big dogs poop so big.
It was like it was saving it up.
It really was.
They didn't bother to wake up Mark Wahlberg. Although, I could see that. Should we wake him?
No.
No, he's just going to keep talking about fucking science.
He'll probably bring up the bees again. Let him sleep. Like, don't go into this old lady's bedroom. He clearly saw it was a doll because the door then was finally fully open and he still said, Mrs. Jones?
Maybe he's got profound face blindness. That could inform his character quite a bit.
Oh, now okay, Betty Buckley's all mad.
Because he saw a wooden doll and he kept walking close to it like it was the plant in the corner that he also couldn't recognize for what it was.
Maybe he can't see very well. Maybe that's why he didn't see the guns going through the doors. See, but then she's one person and yet she's getting...
Hey, you're right.
The happening.
We've just broken the rules. Now it's down to whatever singular person pisses off the plants.
But she wasn't out there like hitting the plants or anything. She's just standing in the garden.
She just walked through in probably like a protected garden path because she's, you know, whatever, a responsible grower. But still, the plants pissed her off. Or she pissed off the plants.
Well, that'll do her.
That was pretty good. I like Okay, wow, I like that. That was a gory throwing your own head through a window. There's something about that. In horror movies, in the last couple of years, we've gotten zombies shooting their own heads through windows. And The Walking Dead had the great one where the guy's face kind of peels away.
Yes.
In the windshield of the car. In this case, Betty Buckley is just walking away with some face shrapnel.
Why do you think, you dummy?
Close the windows and the doors. Why? What could be happening, Mark Wahlberg?
Like, you're in a fucking end-of-the-world situation.
The only thing we know is that the plants are out to get us. Close
but
the
I'm
doors
gonna question
and windows.
Things. Like, what the shit?
Okay, so far up to this point, like, he's been face-to-face with people. And not that they've really gone so far as to like emote around one another and react, but now we have removed them entirely. It's as if like we hit a point in the schedule where the actors were not dually available.
Right, she was filming New Girl. He had to work at Wahlburger.
He's got a shift at the Fryer. Oh, it's her mood ring that he bought her because he can never get a read.
Right.
Because he's got profound face blindness.
Maybe.
That's what it is. On their first date, he bought the mood ring so he would know what the fuck she was feeling. And also because she doesn't like to share her emotions. Now the picture comes full circle. What color was it when she was having tiramisu with Joey?
Yeah, right? This is like how they act in the movie Twilight 2 where they they talk, but then they kind of close their mouth like they puked inside a little, and then they talk again. Maybe it's a style.
Oh, shit. Mark Wahl, I don't remember him crying. Although his eyes are dry as bones.
They're going to put that Vicks underneath him, blow some that Vicks hair in his eyes.
Oh, boy. Who's a worse crier, Mark Wahlberg or David Duchovny?
Oh, David Duchovny is so sad when he cries.
I think I remember seeing like tears when David Duchovny cried. It was an ugly cry.
It's a sad, pathetic cry. Why did he come out here?
Because this is them finally coming together across their personal void. He could have just stayed in there.
What?
All right. He saw Betty Buckley was alone when the plants went after him, so he really is taking the biggest chance. Oh, and now she is risking herself and the child.
And the child, yes.
Yeah, all right. This makes perfect sense.
Because the plants will know that they're in love and leave them alone. Wow. Well, that just happened.
It went from the present to the past. It has happened. We had to sit through it. Ugh. I'm glad we
bookended this with two good films.
Yeah, it'll be tricky to listen back to this. I wonder if there's entertainment value. This could be like 2 minutes of best of chopped
together.
We just
sat through the whole thing you people. Wow.
And we're back to the clouds.
Because even Jackson was like, well, do you want to watch The Happening, you know, before you and Darren watch it for your commentary? And I said, no, I don't want to watch it any more than I have to.
The value it would present to, like, pre-write jokes is not worth the toll of sitting through this movie again.
I never want to watch it again.
But yeah, moving on
to one of, honestly, my favorite, makes me feel so good when I watch this movies. This is 2013's This Is the End, directed by Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg, written by Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg, based on a short film from 2007.
Oh, was it that far before? Okay. I didn't realize. Yeah, the Jay and Seth versus the Apocalypse. Yeah. It's on YouTube. I watched it. I don't know if it's recommendable.
Okay.
It's just a little bit of like testing the premise that they would maybe show this to execs and trying to fundraise, because apparently Fox Studios did not want to make this movie. And
I mean,
they did not like the story.
It's a weird sell, because I will say this. Some listeners of ours would hate this movie.
Okay.
It's the most brotastic film that I think we've ever talked about.
Yeah, I'll go with that.
I will say in this, and, you know, there's a lot of things that we know now that we didn't know then, whatever. This was a film that I had always hated James Franco for no reason. I just really hated him. And then after this movie, I was like, James Franco is awesome. This movie is so funny. He's so funny. I never thought anything about Danny McBride. After this film, I was like, that guy, he's in things, whatever. After this, Danny McBride is so funny.
Have you like become a fan and watched other Danny McBride?
I watched stuff? The Vice Principal show.
Yeah, that was funny.
He's great.
Yeah, I like that a lot. Yeah, I think the studio, there's probably any number of complaints. I think traditionally anything that involves apocalyptic doomsday kind of hellscapes, studios are reluctant to do. In this case, all these actors are playing themselves.
Right.
And they are making themselves look like terrible human beings.
Right.
And I would imagine the studio is probably, James Franco, for whatever you think of him, like, he will get a movie greenlit. Like, the studio will see his face and go like, yeah, we'll give you a couple $1 million to make a movie. And so when they are essentially, like, ruining their reputations on film, the studio's probably not thrilled to invest in that.
Right.
So it was a little slow going. The negotiations kind of went as far as, like, we're going to need a bunch of money to make this end-of-the-world film. The studio's like, we don't like the script. We don't like the story. No, thank you. And so their next like caveat was, how much money would you give us if we could also have final say and final cut in the project. And they're like, like $32 million. They're like, done and done.
Yeah.
But yeah, because most of the movie takes place in James Franco's like new architectural compound, you save a lot of money by just having like a, you know, essentially a set where most of your movie is taking place.
I would say the most of the budget was probably used in the first 10, 15 minutes.
No, the last 15 minutes.
Oh, yeah, that too. So literally 30 minutes of the film is where all the money went. The rest of it takes place in James Franco's house pretty much solely only.
Decorated by a lot of his own paintings, as it turns
yes,
out.
Yes, it is true. Those are his own paintings. We are treated, though, with... It reminded me of the old days in the old, like, Leslie Nielsen films where everyone was in there for some reason.
Okay,
and
yeah.
This was... You have Michael Cera, who also I don't care for, but is so funny in this movie.
Everybody, listen up. Who took my fucking cell phone, man? Martin, empty your pockets.
What?
I saw you in the bathroom, man. Somebody dialed my phone. Shut the fuck up. Unbelievable. It's unacceptable after all the coke I've wasted on you people. Throw it away.
Fucking cell phone.
Three.
Whoa.
One.
Whoa. Mike,
like, I can't even deal with that.
Yeah.
You have Rihanna in there.
Yep. Legit.
Everyone's here.
She's even singing. We've got Kevin Hart making a cameo. I mean, like, more like speaking role cameos. Channing Tatum is a nice sort of save for last.
Yeah.
We've got Mindy Kaling. But filling out the cast overall, we've got, of course, Seth Rogen, Jay Baruchel, James Franco, Jonah Hill, Danny McBride, Craig Robinson, who I've recently had a celebrity sighting of.
Really? I love Craig Robinson.
In Park Slope, which I was not expecting to run into.
Love but, Hot Tub Time Machine.
And yeah, we've got Michael Cera, David Krumholz, a small role. Martin Starr is in there for a minute or two.
And Hermione. Hermione
right.
joins the party.
Emma Watson for like one of the funnier sort of drop-ins.
Right.
But we're forgetting
Jonah Hill.
Jonah Hill and McLovin. I don't remember that actor's name. Sorry.
We'll call him McLovin. It's fine.
When Michael Cera blows cocaine into his face. There's some of the most outlandish shit associated
with Michael Cera's scenes. Funny in this movie.
Yeah. I guess he was really worried the direction his career was going, like, you know, this is going back to like post Juno. He was the awkward nerdy teenager. He was his, you know, the expanded universe of his Arrested Development character.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was growing more and more frustrated, and some of the shit that he's asked to do in this movie, he was more than thrilled. I think the only caveat was like, I want to wear this windbreaker, and it's like the dumbest dad style windbreaker.
It's what I would expect, though. It's what I would expect from him.
These days it's kind of come around where it's kind of like hipster chic, where
right.
like the like mom jeans Norm-y and dad kind of dad thing. Core normcore. That's kind of what he styled. But yeah, in any case, we get to see him do some pretty wild shit in this movie. The least of them is blowing cocaine in McLovin's face.
Yes. So the synopsis is, six Los Angeles celebrities are stuck in James Franco's house after a series of devastating events just destroyed the city. Inside, the group will not only have to face down the apocalypse, but also each other.
Yeah, we're so happy! Look at this!
What's happening, man?
Good to see you, buddy. How you doing?
I'm good, man.
Yes, you are.
How long has it been, man?
Sometime in the last, inside of a year or something.
I have the best weekend ever planned, man.
Lay it on me.
I don't want to ruin it.
Oh, Seth Rogen.
Hey. How's it going, man?
Yeah, good.
So you, like, always play, like, the same guy in every movie. When are you going to do some, like, real acting, man?
Okay, thank you.
Give me something. Give me, like, the laugh, man. Give me the Seth Rogen laugh.
Seth Rogen, everybody.
So it starts with Jay coming to L.A. Seth Rogen's picking him up. Seth Rogen is the Seth Rogen we all know, and he's famous Seth Rogen.
He's followed by TMZ at the airport.
Exactly.
He's asked to do his stoner laugh.
It's charming.
I've caught myself doing it, and I worried about myself. I might have made some life changes.
Oh, no. But we can kind of tell from the beginning that Jay is just not into this Hollywood thing. Seth Rogen is also Canadian, but he's more maybe in tune with his Canadian roots. And Seth Rogen has gone full Hollywood.
Yeah, they've among the interviews, they kind of talked about how, yes, this is a very exaggerated type of story, but it was kind of playing on some of their dynamics. So it sounds like Jay Baruchel probably doesn't live full time in LA.
Right.
Well, in any case, so Jay Baruchel, a filmmaker, is in his own right. He's very, I think he does have the maple leaf tattoo. I don't remember where, but they've shown it off
in
Judd Apatow movies. But in any case, he's supposed to be like the most relatable non-Hollywood of the group, and that's kind of his issue, that everybody else is sort of bought into this lifestyle. He doesn't particularly like James Franco or any of the group, really.
Right. So they're having this huge party at James Franco's house, and that's when we get all these people and you see all these different celebrities. In the meantime, Jay and Seth go to the 7-Eleven, essentially. And that is when...
In a decidedly un-Hollywood Hills neighborhood.
Yeah, it seems like very... It reminds me of where, like, Cher got robbed in Clueless. Like, why are you there? So they're in the 7-Eleven, and that is when blue light starts coming from the sky.
Earthquakes. Yeah.
Yes, and shit, all hell breaks loose. Literally.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, it's both heaven and hell, right? Because people ascend, but at the same time...
Yeah, some of the people get raptured.
Yeah, but Seth Rogen is not, he's knocked over by like a rack of something. So he doesn't witness the ascension.
Right.
So Jay is the only person who has a sense of what might be going on. But yeah, try convincing other people that the apocalypse is happening. We've already talked about it. You either get lucky and have a cult or get looked at as a nut job.
It's true. It's true.
It's not wildfires. It's not earthquakes. It's not sinkholes. I think I know what it is.
Let's hear it.
I think it's the apocalypse. I'm serious, boys. It's all in here. In the book of Revelations.
You took my Bible?
Well, just hear me out. You tell me that what I'm describing isn't what's going on right now. And the skies shall open up, and the light of the Lord shall shine down, and those of good heart shall be brought into my kingdom of heaven. That's the rapture. Those are the gigantic beams of blue light. And there will be a great mountain burning in fire. I mean, the Hollywood Hills are literally engulfed in flames as we sit here right now.
The Hollywood Hills ain't no mountain. It's a hill. It takes about 10 minutes to get across that motherfucker with no traffic.
Cold water.
I take Laurel Canyon.
Boys,
can I just fucking finish?
Okay. I love Laurel Canyon.
And out of the pit rose a great red dragon having 7 heads. That old serpent called the devil and Satan, which deceiveth the whole world, was released unto the earth.
I love that dude. He's from Where the Wild Things Are.
It's a load of bullshit.
It's not bullshit.
You want to know something else, Jay? If this is the end of the world and all the good people died, what you're saying is Seth, me, Jonah, Craig, and Danny are a bunch of assholes.
I'm straight up lovable, son.
Yeah, and if this really is the apocalypse, you're here too. So that means you're just as shitty as the rest of us. Doesn't feel too good, does it?
So they decide it's more than just a regular old earthquake, regular kind of sinkhole situation.
The hills are on fire.
It seems very bad, so everyone goes inside the house. And at that point in time, they don't even know Danny McBride is there.
No.
And they decide, okay, we need to ration, we need to do all these things. They go to sleep. The next morning, Danny McBride has taken all their rations because he doesn't know anything's going on.
And makes a bomb-ass breakfast.
Yes, he does. And that scene is hilarious, and I love Danny McBride.
Franco! Good morning, sunshine!
Guys, wake up! Danny's alive! He's eating all the fucking food!
No,
he's
no.
For you guys,
stop eating
another piece of bacon.
Guys, just chill the fuck out, okay? I'm sure the Green Goblin can fucking afford some more bacon.
Dude, this shit's supposed to last us till we get rescued.
Wait a second. I know what happened. You guys dropped acid, didn't you? Mm-hmm. Craig doesn't have any pants on. He got fucking wild, probably danced, sweated all over the place. You got white shit all over your mouth, Frankie. You probably sucked somebody's dick. Jonah over here probably watched and jerked off. Jay, I didn't even know you were in town. Good to see you.
Danny, we're not on acid. We didn't suck each other's dicks.
James Franco didn't suck any dick last night. Now I know you all are tripping.
You actually not know what happened last night?
Daniel, you may want to stay seated for a second. Some really messed up stuff happened, and there were a lot of fatalities.
Oh, really? You're putting your serious voice on, Jonah? Okay, tell me about these fatalities.
Dude, Siegel's dead. Krumholz is dead. Michael Cera's dead.
Yeah, so Michael Cera's gone. It's not a total loss, huh?
Jesus, Danny.
Michael Cera's dead.
It's not like that. That's
not funny, man.
But he's being a real asshole. And it's like, it's one of those situations where you can't always choose who you're with at the end of the world. And I would not choose Danny McBride.
No. He's the guy who's going to get you all killed.
It's so true. So that happens and certain things go on beyond that. But one of my most favorite scenes, and which it was originally, they showed this clip and it was going to be Pineapple Express 2. Like they showed it as a joke in theaters. And that became one of the advertisements for This Is the End. But you didn't even know it belonged to any other movie. You just thought it was this weird...
Oh, I don't remember
Pineapple
that.
Express 2. And they make a home video of Pineapple Express 2, the sequel.
Like fully edited. It's got the beats
it's
of
so
a ridiculous Pineapple
funny.
Express 2. Yeah, and they talk about it. They sort of brainstorm between Franco and Seth Rogen, like, you know, making a sequel. And what would it be? James Franco is obsessed with dying for Seth Rogen. Like, he is in love
yeah.
with Seth Rogen.
Yes, in this film, very much so.
Don't mess with the painting. Mess with mine, man. Don't take down Seth's painting. I think it's probably just comes down to, like, thoughtful writing, of which it seems to vary between Evan Goldberg and Seth Rogen. They've talked about whether the movie was 50% ad-libbed or maybe as much as 85% ad-libbed. Mm-hmm. But definitely one of the things that they wrote out was this idea for Pineapple Express 2 and these beats where the Danny McBride character eventually eats James Franco. And so, like, they set up these beats. They you know, record it.
Good thing I have a lot of fucking weed for you guys. I hooked you guys up. Now I need you guys to assassinate Woody Harrelson. If pot's legalized, my business will suffer. And if my business suffered, I suffer. So much suffering. All because of that inbred hemp seed, Woody Harrelson.
I have to do what's right. Weed is for the people. It's the people's weed.
If you don't assassinate him, I'm going to assassinate both of you.
Bro!
Look out, shit! You're letting them get away!
I smoked weed with Steve Jobs, and that's when he came up with the iPad. It's pretty great.
We should make sequels to more of our movies.
How about we not do Your Highness 2?
That's how we feel.
One of my favorite scenes comes, I think it was probably about the halfway to two-thirds point in the story, is when one of the characters is raped by a demon. It happens in Shadow. It's not gratuitous. It's distinctly homaging Rosemary's Baby and then later The Exorcist. But the fallout of that scene and the possession itself is so funny that I think it is my favorite moment in the movie. It's one of my favorite dynamics because it is kind of like, hey, if you and I had to put together an exorcism
right.
on the fly,
this is pretty much what it would come to.
Yeah, I don't know where else I would. I don't know. I'd ask questions until the demon got tired of, like, making shit up. I don't know what I would do. I would quote movies. I would do what they do.
Yeah, I mean, basically all I know is I need to know the demon's name.
Oh, right. That's a big important thing. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, basically what I would go off of. Because I feel like once I get their name, then I'm cool, right? That seems to...
Okay.
Then I'd be like, get out, jungler. And I would try jungler first.
I forgot that was one that we... That was a demon we addressed back in the day. I think in the spiritualism episode. But yeah, no, in this case, they've taped together some kitchen utensils to make a crucifix. Do you have a crucifix in your home? Anywhere?
No, I do not. I have,
yeah, I don't
like,
even have
saint
like an
medallions,
artwork.
But I don't have any crosses
yeah.
in here.
Do those, are those like
I
presents
have a
that you get? Where, oh, a rosary too. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't have any like religious iconography in my home.
I I do.
I'd be down to like the fingers. Stuff. I'd have to cross fingers and power of Christ compels you.
Oh, good luck to you on that. Because then you got to like get really close. No, I do have like a rosary and some saints. So I guess I would go to that. And then I have a ton of like Bibles, Bhagavad Gita.
Yeah,
I got the Quran over there.
Yeah.
I'll try everything. I'll just throw it at them. If it comes down to it.
At the very least, we're hitting a person with books, and that could do some good. That
knock some sense into you.
Maybe I should put, like, in my go bag, maybe I should put some, like, cross. A little cross. A rosary would suffice, maybe.
Yeah, just maybe.
Press that against the forehead of a
exactly.
possessed
the other
person.
Thing is just in case you came upon a religious group that had tons of supplies, you'll be like, I'm also religious. See this religious article?
Yeah, yeah.
Don't ask me really details.
Our episode with the Miskatonic Musing guys was just posted recently, and there is a really manipulative moment where they encounter strangers. This is post-apocalyptic America, and he tries to ingratiate himself to the other group by like, yeah. Hey, fellow Christians, and we're one of y'all.
So you might need that cross.
Maybe I should put a rosary in my go bag. That's a good idea. It's light. I mean, at least
it's
light. Convenient.
It's small.
Yeah, yeah. I'll get one of the plastic ones.
Wards off vampires.
Easy peasy.
Done.
Saves me from carrying garlic.
Excellent. My favorite scene in this movie is really what turned the tables for me about being so much Danny McBride and James Franco.
This is the clip you played for me before we started.
Yeah.
Who did this?
Did what? What are you talking about?
Jizzed all over the pages of this nice magazine I was nice enough to tell you about.
It was me, Franco. I fucking made jizz in your magazine.
What?
When I fucking jack off long enough, I end up jizzing, dude. I'm assuming the same shit works for you.
Real fucking smart answer. Why don't you fucking aim, huh?
I have a particularly explosive ejaculate. It just goes everywhere. It's like a fucking wild fireman's hose. You just gotta grab on and pray to God it doesn't get in your eyes or your mouth.
The fuck kind of jerking off is that? What, you never had any brothers? You didn't learn to jizz in a fucking sock or on a fucking tissue?
No, I don't have any brothers. I was raised in a house of women.
I highly doubt they fucking taught you to fucking close your eyes and fucking come wherever you want.
I mean, you're getting all worked up over a fucking porno mag. Who has goddamn porno mags anymore? Welcome to the 21st century, Buck Rogers. You designed a house with fucking iPads in the walls. Yet you're jerking your dick like a goddamn pilgrim.
That's right, man. I like to fucking read.
You think that's the only thing I jerked off in here? I've been dropping loads around this fucking house like a goddamn dump truck.
You don't come on my stuff.
I'll come on your fucking art. I'll come anywhere I want.
I will fucking come right on you. I will come like a fucking madman all over you, McBride.
Ooh, I fucking wish you'd come on me right now. I fucking dare you to come on me. I'm gonna jerk my dick so fucking hard in here. Oh, fuck this. I'm too thirsty to do this, and the fucking bitter irony is I'm not gonna have my thirst quenched until I finish this. God damn it, I
Danny,
hate it.
No, don't walk away. Danny, don't walk
it's
away from
late,
me.
It's too late, Seth. I've already walked away too much.
No, you haven't. You could still come back and just fucking turn around and come back and help me.
The whole scene, it goes for like 2.5 minutes, and I just think it's the funniest thing ever. And Seth Rogen is laughing.
He's right.
He's standing right next to Danny McBride, and he's laughing, and I mean, I don't know how many times I've quoted anything from that scene. A million times, hand gestures and everything when I'm trying to explain.
I like to read.
And it's so stupid and funny. Why don't people like this movie?
Who doesn't like this movie?
Some people don't like this movie because it's a little
sacrilegious.
I don't, it's like very brotastic, like I said in the beginning.
It is, yeah.
It's very brotastic.
Yeah, the scene with Emma Watson.
Emma Watson, Hermione, you could call her.
The scene with Hermione kind of really, really touches on that very specifically. Yeah. And it's funny that Jay Baruchel, who's supposed to be our like sympathetic character, is the one who's like overthinking things and just kind of ruins it because it can be terribly frightening at the end days to be trapped with a bunch of dudes. It's a 28 right. days later scenario.
Absolutely. Everything keeps going back to that episode with Miskatonic Musings.
Okay, so where is it's not as intrinsic a part as, say, music plays in Edgar Wright's films. Here we've got a couple music drops that are pretty funny. I think it's kind of fascinating that Backstreet's Back is used here not ironically. It's just kind of used as like, hey man, this is a banger, this is a jam,
right,
and we're enjoying it. because I didn't, you know, I wasn't a Backstreet Boys fan in my day. But it was on the radio. It was unavoidable. And it's a fun song.
Yeah.
So when it's played like without irony and then comes back.
I think there's some really good things on the soundtrack. You do have Backstreet Boys. You have that Whitney Houston, Dolly Parton. Oh. I Will Always Love You, which is so good. Mickey Mousing with Spirit in the Sky when that comes on. But also there's like KRS-One, which is like, I love when you see KRS-One. You never do. So this film originally started as End of the World. That's what it was going to be titled, was End of the World. Because of the world's end, Simon Pegg actually sent a letter to these guys saying, hey, we can't change our movie, The World's End. It's literally the title of one of the bars.
Yeah.
So please change your title of your film if you could. That would be great because it both came out in the summer of 2013. So they did, and it became This Is the End.
Nice.
So that's a nice bookend with our opening movie and our ending movie.
I like it. I like it. And I like that they were deferential. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
All right, so as we bring it to a close, I guess I'm thankful that the world isn't ending.
It's true. I also am thankful.
You've got a big something to look forward to, that's certain.
Yes, I don't want to be in an apocalypse and pregnant.
Well, like the John Krasinski A Quiet Place, it turns out not to work out so great.
Yeah.
You don't want to have to, like, silent box your baby.
No, it's true. Seems like a bad idea.
But yeah, so fingers crossed we don't see the end times anytime soon. Although the news, I don't know. I mean, I think that's kind of why this episode was on my mind, was that every other day it does kind of feel like it could end at any minute now.
So I've been reading the graphic novel DMZ.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm thinking probably apocalypse not going to happen, but maybe DMZ. And if Manhattan is the DMZ and I survive the first, like, wave of probably carpet bombing, I'm going to hang out here in the DMZ, I think. I'm not going to go over to Long Island, and I'm not going to go over to the mainland either.
I thought your plan, yeah, I thought when the shit goes down, you're moving in country.
But if it's like a bunch of yahoos in the regular other part of the country, I'm not going to go to them.
I don't know. Are the yahoos going to outnumber us, though?
Well, if you read the fucking book, which I think I lent to
you. The prophetic DMZ.
So if anyone else is reading DMZ, why don't you tell Darren to read it too?
Well, I don't know. At this rate, like, it's almost, it feels like a competition between, like, I don't know, nuclear annihilation and just floodwaters, you know, kind of making coastal cities out of, like, Philadelphia.
Yes. Doesn't look good for us on the island of Manhattan.
Don't let it get you down, people. We'll be here. We're not actually closing out the episode. It's not the end of the world for us. That's an important note.
It is just 150 for us, and we will be continuing.
Here's to 150 more?
Yeah, why not?
That's a goal. That's an ambitious goal. I think Miskatonic Musings hit 250 recently.
That's insane.
Is that possible? I think maybe they're nearing in on 250. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's a shining example. I love to death. I kept telling them that their episode 200 was a thing of beauty. And we'll get there.
Yeah.
We'll get there. We'll start planning now.
That's good. That's a good idea. If you can't get enough of us, though, check out Miskatonic's latest episode that has been out. It's called Don't Shit Your Pants, something like that.
Or like Shit Your Pants and Keep Moving.
Yeah, because I was really proud because I was the one who said Shit Your Pants. I got to be the title and I was so proud of myself.
That's funny. Yeah, in that episode we covered Red Rain, the short story, and the movie Carriers from like 2006. I don't know. It kind of fluctuated between when it was made and when it came out, but Spanish filmmakers with Chris Pine in the lead.
Yeah.
I mean, the fun of that is talking with Charles and Sean of Miskatonic Musings.
So if you want to get some extra of us there, you can do that. You can always check us out at Patreon, patreon.com/rantsmacabre. We are going to continue this idea of end of the world this month. We're going to talk about doomsday cults and AHS's cult.
Yeah. For even more Rants Macabre content, you can follow us on social media. We are at Rants Macabre at all the extensions, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. We got lucky on that one. Some people have to switch up their name, but we are at Rants Macabre.
Also, our email is therantsmacabre@gmail.com, where you can drop us a line. Let us know. The theme of apocalyptic horror is plentiful, and there's clearly the Christopher Lee movie I'd never heard of, but right. I might track that down.
One of my favorite ones, these final hours.
Yeah, and I was thinking the one that we actually saw in the movie theater thinking it was The Happening became one of your favorites, The Signal.
Yes.
And that's kind of an end days scenario. But yeah, drop us a line, let us know what some of your favorites are. We love hearing from you guys. While we're in that mode of hearing from you guys, why don't you drop us a line at iTunes or Stitcher Internet Radio? Give us some stars, give us some reviews.
Absolutely.
Helps us grow the show. But as always, thank you for listening, and that'll do it for me. This is Darren, signing off.
This is Mindy. Thanks. I feel fine.